This is a podcast from the British Council's Going Global 2013.
First, I'd like to introduce our speakers and in the order that they will present, and so you can put a name with a face. First is Carolyn Campbell, to my far right at the end of the table. Carolyn is the head of international affairs at the Quality Assurance Agency for higher education in the UK. Carolyn is responsible for the development and implementation of QAA's international strategy and for managing the international collaboration team. She serves on a number of international... Hear me now? Is that better? Okay. So did you hear anything about Carolyn? She'll never let me live it down if you didn't. Finally, Carolyn's been involved with numerous organizations such as OECD, UNESCO, and continues to serve on the board of the Observatory on Borderless Higher Education. So welcome, Carolyn. To her left is Dr. Miriam Rabb. Miriam is the registrar with Fatima Jinnah Women College, University in Pakistan. She has worked in the public service sector for the last 16 years. Her experience varies from teaching and research and management. She has a master's in education management from King's College London and has done her doctorate in education from the Institute of Education, University of London. Welcome, Miriam. To her left is Vangelis Sivagirius. How'd I do there?
You got it right.
Pretty good? All right, good. That's a hard one. Vangelis is an economist by training and for the past 10 years has been setting up, leading, and managing higher education partnerships between private and for-profit education institutions and UK universities. He completed his doctorate at Birmingham City University titled Cross-Border Higher Education and Quality Management. Welcome to this. To my right is Chris Hill. Chris is the director of the Graduate School at the University of Nottingham, Malaysia campus. He is involved in all aspects of graduate study and research training. Since he arrived in Malaysia in January 2008, he has worked with partner universities throughout Malaysia to promote collaboration and research development. So welcome, Chris. The range of our presentations today is going to cover some different perspectives and look at TNE and the issues of quality in light of where these distinguished speakers sit. Carolyn will talk about a recent review of TNE in China that was conducted by QAA. Miriam is going to talk about some of the developments of a new partnership at her university in Pakistan. Vangelis is going to talk about some of his research from his doctoral thesis relative to TNE, and Chris is going to talk about TNE and a review that has been done in Malaysia and some of the things that have come out of that and some of his own individual research. So we hope you're going to get a nice range of perspectives on this topic. And by the way, my name is Don Alcott. I am the head of strategic planning and engagement for the Higher Colleges of Technology here in the UAE. And before this, I was the chief executive of the Observatory on Borderless Higher Education in London. As you can see from the title, I'm going to keep my comments very short and we can move on to Carolyn. Part of the title is talking about how stakeholders view TNE. And one of the questions I hope you'll take with you today, and I think all of us would agree with this, is you need to ask yourself who your stakeholders are. We always make assumptions about how simple that sounds. Before I came to this session, I wrote down a TNE initiative I was involved with, and this was just the list of stakeholders that I had to deal with. Host country, students, and employers, and the agency or partner I was working with, a quality assurance agency, either from the provider country or in some context from the host country. University faculty, you ever had a discussion with one of your peers on your campus who says, why are we going overseas? We have too many issues and too many things to pay for here. Why are we doing that? Your administration, your board, the local community asking some of those same questions. The local community that you serve in your home country in that area says, why are you 10,000 miles away when we need A, B, and C here? So my point is simply this, is you need to really think about who are your stakeholders and prioritizing those. And I think you will hear a little bit about that today. The other point I think I'd like to make is, if you go back about 15 years, the movement in open and distance learning, I think we all agree now technology has taken off unbelievably. I also remember some discussions even then from faculty who said, this will just be a passing phase. The web, the internet, all of that. It's like all that other technology that came before it. It's going to be gone. Well, still here, isn't it? It's not going anywhere. What is interesting, I think, is the quality arena has actually had a similar evolution. A lot of my background is from North America, Canada, and the U.S. And up until 2000, the word assessment, student learning outcomes, any of that was almost non-existent. And then accountability hit the streets, and quality hit the streets. Today, most institutions have to outline for the accrediting commissions or whatever agency that accredits your institution, you know, what are the student learning outcomes that a student should expect if they take your program? A relevant question also for T&E. Okay. Institutional outcomes. I mean, you're asked to write institutional outcomes of what most students should be able to have acquired by getting a university education from your institution. So I'm going to stop there, and I'm going to let Carolyn get going. But again, the context of both quality and who your stakeholders are, those are very critical questions in thinking through this process. I don't think the quality, accountability, you can call it institutional effectiveness, whatever you like, is going away. It's going to be, as Martin Bean said yesterday in his presentation, perhaps one of the most distinguishing factors that's going to allow your institution and your partners to have a competitive advantage in this global market. So with no further ado, I'd like to turn it over to Carolyn, and we'll get going.
Thank you for your introduction, Dawn. Can everybody hear me at the back of the room? Thank you. Good morning, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. Slightly intimidating given the number of familiar faces that I see in the room and people who know a great deal about transnational education. Perhaps I should just explain very quickly that QAA is the National Quality Assurance Agency for Higher Education in the United Kingdom. And we have the responsibility of not only reviewing higher education, but also of developing and maintaining the UK Quality Code for Higher Education, which is the definitive reference point for quality and standards used by institutions and used by QAA in its review process. I think that many people in this room, and given that you've probably been to other sessions, are familiar with what transnational education is. It's about the delivery of education across national borders to students who may be nationals of the country where the education is being delivered, but in some locations definitely may not be. I should also say that QAA has been reviewing UK transnational education since 1997. It used to be called Overseas Audit, but we've moved with the times, and it's now called Transnational Education Review. And each year, we have selected a country with significant UK transnational education provision and or challenges around that provision and reviewed a sample of provision which is delivered in country. Mainland China was our destination in 2012. And we know that more than 60 UK universities deliver in-country provision to more than 34,000 students in China. So it's one of the major locations in terms of student numbers for UK transnational education. The others in the sort of top four being Malaysia, Singapore, and the SAR, Hong Kong. To give you an idea why it is important that we review transnational education, some data about the extent of UK transnational education provision should be of interest. And I should also point out that one of QAA's strategic aims is to protect the interests of students studying for UK higher education qualifications, however and wherever, that's in the UK and abroad. According to the most recent HESA, that's the Higher Education Statistics Agency data, more than 120 UK universities are engaged in some form of transnational education provision. And the geographical spread of this is huge, more than 200 countries. And those of you who were at other sessions yesterday may have heard that in 2010, the number of transnational education students overtook the number of international students studying in the UK. But if you add up the figures together, you can see that we have a million reasons or a million stakeholders who want to be reassured about the quality of UK higher education, whether it's transnational or not. We carried out a previous review in China in 2006, and from the feedback we had, we know that the impact was perceived as being limited. We only went to Beijing and Shanghai. China is a big country, and those might be big cities, but there's a lot more to China than that. And we conducted it without the involvement of China's own regulatory authorities, who, of course, are major stakeholders in relation to the quality of transnational education. So when we started planning the review for 2012, we started by asking ourselves whether the level of scrutiny applied to UK transnational education was sufficient and whether it would be perceived as sufficient by the stakeholders in and the users of TNE in China. In particular, we looked at how best to address the two key needs underlying perceptions that the impact before was limited, namely the need for broad coverage of UK transnational education and the need to raise the profile of the review and the outcomes in China itself. We set out to achieve the first need by undertaking a comprehensive survey of UK transnational education in China. Yes, we had the HESA data. Yes, we had the information from the ministry. They didn't match up, so we did our own survey. We also followed this by desk-based studies focusing on extant documents provided by a large sample of UK institutions who had significant in-country provision. That's with students, more than 50 students in the country. And when it came to the China visits, the actual visits in China, we travelled further within the country, reviewing provision not only in Beijing and Shanghai, but also in Kunming, Dalian, Ningbo, and Suzhou. We think we've achieved visibility and raised the profile of review through close cooperation with our nearest counterpart organization in China, which is the China Academic Degrees and Graduate Development Center, the acronym of which is CDGDC. It doesn't quite match up, but that's what it is, and I feel very pleased I'm able to just say it like that, CDGDC. This is the Ministry of Education agency, which has responsibility for the regulation of all Sino-foreign partnerships delivering education within China. And colleagues from this agency participated in briefing workshops, but also participated in some of the review visits. They were free to come to all the visits, but they selected five to come along. And they have provided useful feedback to us on their perceptions of our process. So it's engagement with the stakeholders. We are, of course, publishing the results of the review visits and case studies. And this is another way of raising the profile of what has been done and reaching a wider group of stakeholders, namely the public, through the publication of reports. We publish overview reports too, providing a perspective on the total UK provision in China. They look They're nicely coloured. They look sort of like this, but we're going to have a yellow cover for the Chinese report, and we're debating whether to put a snake on the cover because it is the year of the snake. But on the other hand, do we really want QAA to be associated with that? We're not quite sure. But anyway, that's by the by. Another key need was set out from the start, and that was the interest of UK stakeholders in the review process. How is it funded? Is it cost-effective? And we did find some ways of making it cost-effective through not visiting all the UK partners in the UK, but basing things on desk-based studies and focusing our review visits in China, where we were able to talk to students. This is a very important part of the process. Talk to the staff who are engaged in delivering the programs, as well as participating with our regulatory partners. I am keen to show that our process actually, although the review visit looks like the very sort of interesting part of it, I'm keen to show that it's actually not just about a one-day visit, that there's a lot of research that goes and desk-based study that goes into the activity beforehand. We gather more evidence from the visits, and then we are reporting. We want to make this clear to everybody concerned. It's not that we just dropped in for one day to an institution and have come to conclusions about quality and standards. We are in the business, in the process, I should say, at the moment, of drafting the review reports. But I'd like to, just very quickly to give you some sort of headlines or some sort of recurring themes from the visits to the which will appear in the review reports. In relation to the multiplicity of models of provision, we know that China's approach to transnational education has been a bit eclectic, with the ground rules being fairly lax to start off with in terms of wanting volume, quantity of TNE. And this led to a proliferation of a variety of Sino-foreign partnerships of varied quality. But the rules have been tightened over the last few years to encourage some particular types of modules and to discourage others. So UK institutions need to keep abreast of shifts in Chinese thinking and changes in the regulatory environment. As already mentioned, the Ministry of Education has kept issuing further guidance on how to implement the relevant domestic regulations concerning transnational education. And indeed, the feedback offered to us by CDGDC is that our review teams should have paid more attention to Chinese policies and regulations. Our comment, of course, is that it's not QAA's job to implement Chinese rules, but it is our job to make sure that UK institutions are aware of these rules and are implementing them. And this is because of issues around sustainability of the provision, but also the employability of the graduates, making sure that the degrees are recognised. Because in Chinese TNE, we know that more than 90% of the students are Chinese. They might be looking for an international degree to travel, but on the other hand, the majority of them are going to be employed in China. So it's very important that their degrees are recognised. We know that China operates a system of degree program accreditation and favours dual degrees, double degrees. And this is something that institutions have to be aware of. And it also, in the case of China, means that students have an additional burden because they have additional things to do to meet Chinese requirements, such as physical education and political education, which isn't part of the UK degree. We also know, too, that there's a system for official recognition of foreign degrees, and the CSCSE is the relevant department of the ministry, which has now set up an online platform called Degree Certificate Recognition. So TNE students have to register on this in order to make sure that the degree is going to be recognised. We know that China is looking for the import of expert foreign educational resources. They're looking for staff to come in to teach. They're interested in different pedagogy. This is something that we will be commenting on. There are also a lot of issues around the use of English language. In fact, we actually reviewed a provision which was taught in Mandarin, which brings its own challenges around quality assurance. But there are issues around teaching and learning in the English language. And some of them include the need for students who are studying in English actually to learn Chinese technical language. Again, this comes back to employability, for example, in engineering. So it's fine to know all the technical terms in English, but it's actually very important that they know them in Chinese as well. I won't say too much around assessment and moderation and external examining, but that is just the challenge of introducing things that are specific to UK quality assurance in a different cultural context. And finally, there are issues around the importance of the protection overall of the UK higher education brand in China. Finally, and Dawn will sigh with relief here, there are issues around perceptions of quality. It's not easily measured in practice, and sometimes perceptions can be influenced by a number of factors that are actually beyond QAA's control and remit. Indicators such as university reputation and ranking are often used as proxies, in particular in a country such as China, which does admire prestige and respects hierarchies. Word of mouth and parents' views, parents are very important stakeholders in China, are also factors that influence students' choice of program and institution in China, perhaps more strongly than in some other countries. But nevertheless, we believe that through the TNE China review, by engaging not only in review but partnership activity with stakeholders in China, including students, academic staff, institutions and regulatory authorities, we've contributed to show that the UK and its universities, which, like their Chinese partners, have different motivations for collaboration, are in the majority of cases exercising a duty of care about the quality of UK transnational education in China, and that this should be regarded as one of the reasons why they're successful. Finally, we will be publishing all of this, and we start publishing next week on the 12th of March. We will be publishing the 4 case study reports at our annual conference. The rest will follow in April. So I hope you look forward to reading them and look forward to your feedback as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'd like to invite Dr. Siligirius now to come up.
Okay. It's always a great pleasure to participate in such an important event. So thank you all for attending this session. In today's session, I'm going to briefly discuss about the current approach in managing quality in TNE, and then present some of the findings of my PhD study on student expectations and perceptions that will lead us to the discussion of the emergence of a proposed model for the prospective management of quality in TNE. A rare case of agreement between academics is on the disagreement about how to define quality in higher education. What we conceive as good quality is influenced, despite our perceptions, by a range of contextual dynamics. However, in the past years, we observe a convergence of the various quality management models towards the importance of educational quality. The main model for the definition of educational process has been developed by Biggs, the so-called 3P model, which is later developed by Finney and Usher as a model to manage educational quality. All of the authors have argued that the actual learning outputs and the final outcomes will depend upon students' beginning characteristics. Despite the wider acceptance of these models, in the recent works on educational quality, there is too much emphasis on identifying the dimensions which are linked to outputs, while there is very little effort on exploring student beginning characteristics. Additionally, there is too much focus on student satisfaction surveys, despite research evidence showing a very weak link between student satisfaction and educational quality. While also the use of student feedback and other indicators is feeding an ineffective retrospective management of quality. So the current approach is that we correct problems after this occur, and we apply our solutions to a different cohort of students. The current trend is to identify the variables that are associated with satisfactory outputs and then use them as indicators of quality for prospective students. This, along with the retrospective use of student feedback, is problematic because the relationship between the variables in all the three stages of the educational process will be unique for each student cohort. Therefore, it's highly unlikely to replicate an educational process simply because, as it is widely accepted, students have different beginning characteristics. So, are we really using an effective quality management approach? This question becomes more complex if we consider it in a TNE context. It has been greatly argued that quality assurance in TNE is dominated by the exporting country guidelines. Let me pause here and say that the recent QAEA review of the TNE guidelines is a step in the positive direction, but still, again, lots to be done on this field. Less effort is made on quality enhancement, and more effort, too much I will say, is on ensuring the minimum standards. Clearly, the strategic approach of these guidelines is on the mitigation of risk by the adoption of a next theory approach, placing it in a McGregor's theory analogy. Existing quality systems in TNE are focusing on equivalency between the exporting institution and the partner. Considering the diversity of student factors, the cultural differences, and the social capital benefits created offshore, the focus on sameness is neither appropriate nor beneficial, and this has been highlighted by almost all speakers in this conference. So, together with this previous observation, this completes the picture about the existing retrospective one-fits-all model, which is currently used for the management of quality in TNE. So if we are really interested in assuring educational quality in TNE, then why we ignore student factors, student expectations, and student perceptions? Are we assuming that student factors are the same? And this assumption, is it valid? So this was one of the issues I have explored in my PhD research, a mixed methods case study exploring student factors in two different locations of delivery of the same undergraduate program. The setting of the research, a TNE partnerships between a Greek private college and a UK higher education institution. Some of the findings were that students in different locations of delivery perceive differently quality in higher education. However, both student groups consider educational quality as the prime element of quality in higher education. Student expectations and perceptions about quality are influenced by contextual dynamics, family and domestic higher education system. Students tend to associate direct contribution in the payment of fees with an expectation for a more passive role in their learning process. There is a clear inverse relationship between organizational size and student expectations. Students in the importing country recognize the differentiation of the award institution program, but they do expect a teaching and learning approach which replicates the one used in the domestic education system. The way students in the importing country perceive TNE influences their expectations about educational quality. So from the findings from this research, an emerging conceptual framework can be drawn. From the research, it was found that certain student-related contextual dynamics will affect student perceptions about the meaning of quality in higher education. Reflecting on what Caroline said previously, I think this also is verified by the work of QAA. This will shape, first, factors of influence for the choice of program and university, student expectations on the higher education provision, and students' evaluation about the role of the TNE. This means that student expectations and perceptions about higher educational quality will depend upon these elements and the interaction of these factors. This implies that what students expect in regards to their role in the educational process will be shaped by contextual factors, thus student beginning characteristics cannot be taken as fixed. Also, the way that students will evaluate quality will be subject to these contextual dynamics. And this justifies the need for a contextualized model for a number of reasons. Failure to explore, measure, and manage student expectations and perceptions prior to delivery is very likely that will lead to poor quality outputs and unreliable measurements via student surveys. This applies to all facets and conceptualizations of quality in higher education, and most importantly, on educational quality. The identification and the rigid use of a static relationship between inputs and outputs does not guarantee consistent replication of the provision, either at home or offshore. Instead, the consideration of student factors prior to delivery will allow a better planning of the provision and the necessary actions to readjust student expectations and perceptions. A prospective approach is needed because it allows better quality outcomes and higher retention rates, and it reassures an interesting alignment between the various stakeholder objectives. So a proposed model for managing quality in TNE can be drawn from the previous observation. And I have to identify here that the purpose of the model is to supplement the existing quality assurance and due diligence processes. So this will run alongside the normal due diligence and quality assurance processes. The important change here is the initiation of the quality management in the pre-planning pre-launch stage of TNE by targeting at the heart of the educational process. So step A will be to explore proactively three elements. First, the education system in the importing country. This will allow the identification of problems related to existing knowledge of students, their studying towards learning, passive versus active, surface versus deep. Second, to explore student beginning characteristics by conducting a survey prior to the TNE program delivery. And finally, it is important to consider contextual factors that affect student factors, for example, cultural or family influence towards learning. Step B will be to reflect on the findings of the analysis on the above three elements and target areas which can be managed proactively. First, the exporting institution, together with a partner, should plan actions to readjust student expectations and perceptions of quality. This, again, is prior to the delivery of the program. Some examples can be a pre-induction period where students are explained what is expected for them in terms of participation, or a more extensive induction, 1 month, or even a consideration for the entire year of adjusting largely inappropriate expectations and perceptions. On the other area, the awarding institution should consider modifications to accommodate the need for contextualization without undermining its institutional standards. Some examples here are changes in the program content, tweaking of assessment, and a possible accommodation of local language. This process will reassure that students' beginning characteristics and inputs are such so as to reassure that the learning outputs and the final outcomes are appropriate. And this is within a context of a prospective Y theory quality management in TNE. So the main proposal of this model is to adopt a practical approach towards contextualized quality management in TNE. The value of this approach lies in the fact that it targets educational quality, which seems to be accepted by the various stakeholders, and can help us answer the question as to whether we meet the expectations of all of our stakeholders in TNE. This model proposes a strategic shift that will change quality management in higher education, and I couldn't think of a better place to initiate such a change than going global. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Siligirius. I'd like to invite Dr. Miriam Robb, please.
Thank you, Don. Good morning to you. After listening to the first two presentations, I think I'll take this opportunity to share with you that TNE is comparatively a new phenomenon in higher education in Pakistan. I'm going to talk about specifically what my institution is doing, but it's very important to understand the context of TNE and quality management and assurance in Pakistan. Universities in Pakistan have agreements with different universities in US, UK, and other developed countries' universities to award dual degrees. But since it's quite a recent phenomena, we are in a very unique position where government sector universities are still providing a highly subsidized education to the to the university students, which means that the government is still sharing 80% of the cost of every student who goes to a public sector university. Fatma Jinnah Women's University, the institution where I work, was established in 1998 as the first women's university of the country, with this understanding that the government wanted to provide an institution for women for segregated education. Fortunately for us, with good leadership, we managed to provide a platform for women's empowerment through this university. And the best example of that is that in the last 10 years, we have increased our student strength from 227 to 5,000 young women on campus going through programs of undergraduate, graduate, and postgraduate. At present, we have 8,500 graduates, out of which 49% are working in the market. Either they are employed in the industry and other sectors of education, telecom, across board, and self-employment as well. What is TNE for Fatma Jinnah Women's University? Back in 2004, through a British Council DFID initiative, we were and Higher Education Commission's initiative, we were able to have an agreement with Institute of Education, University of London, to develop course material for our university, which was around higher education leadership and management. It was a modular program that we started in 2007, and the basic purpose of this program was to train women who are aspiring to go into leadership and management position. The idea was emerged from the fact that we saw a huge gap of women not being trained to be deans, vice chancellors, registrars, or even principals of further and further education colleges. when the program was started, it was not TNE in the pure sense. So it was not Institute of Education awarding a degree to the people who were enrolling in Fatma Jinnah Women's University. But it was something which was loosely structured around them developing course modules and also training and jointly teaching the courses in Pakistan. When it started, we started it as a modular program, as I just said, but subsequently it took shape and we had to convert it into a postgraduate MPhil degree because to make it more attractive for our clientele. There was a reason for that as well, which was very local and contextual. We have a very structured service structure and people get benefits both monetary and in terms of their career if they have a higher degree awarded to them during their course of work. Now, so just to highlight the 3 points, it was a kind of a franchise. I would place it in a franchise category, but it was not TNE in the pure sense. But they exported this program to us. We kind of indigenized it, and we made it a recognized qualification in Pakistan. The pilot cohort was inducted in 2007. Since it was a part-time program, we had our first graduate in 2012. Now we have a full session of the same program working, and the university is also in a position now to start its second TNE, which is a TNE in the true sense, because Institute of Education is going to award a certification to the people who enroll in this particular TNE. Coming to the issue of quality assurance. Quality assurance, again, I'll take you a little, again, back to the point that quality assurance is also an initiative which was taken by Higher Education Commission in Pakistan a few years back. And the universities, and especially the public sector universities, were required to set up quality enhancement cells in the universities as independent entities to monitor quality and standard in the university. The result of that was that the regular programs were being monitored and assessed and evaluated, not just students' assessments, but peer reviews and the rest of the modules which have been mentioned, something similar to what QA is doing in the UK. For us, it's an active cell which has been working ever since its inception. And how did this MPhil degree in higher education leadership fall into its purview? We made it an accredited degree by following the structure, the national structures of an MPhil degree, by giving it the exact amount of credits. We made it a comparable degree with other MPhil degrees in the country and in the institution. So anybody who enrolled for this program, for this MPhil program, after getting the degree was eligible to apply for a PhD program anywhere in Pakistan as well as abroad, where the qualifications of Pakistani degrees are recognized. We made it very transparent in the sense that the course material was readily available for whoever was interested in applying on the website. It was also the system of evaluation, marking, and quality assurance was also placed on the web and was available in the printed form for whoever was interested in applying for the program. And we remained very consistent with the teaching practices in the sense that initially we had somebody coming from Institute of Education for every term to teach for that 1 week face-to-face teaching. And then it was slowly and gradually taken over by our Pakistani colleagues who worked with these academics from the Institute of Education. So the faculty was trained while the course was in progress. And we followed the standardized admission criteria for any other MPhil program. And we have structures for admissions, and we have a criteria for admissions for research degrees in Pakistan in place, and we followed that. This degree was, if we go by the UK standard, it was an 120 units degree, which we later converted into credit hours for Pakistan. And so that they, if they wanted to transfer credits to another university, it could be, it was a standardized process that we followed. For us, TNE is still not a fully worked out solution. And there are couple of things that I would like to discuss beyond the presentation that I have just given to you. We need more supportive policies on a national level by the government with regards to TNE because of three major issues. One is a very strong post-colonial perspective that we have. Who's interested in taking up a TNE in country when you have the option of traveling abroad and getting a degree from US, UK, Australia, or any other developed country? If I am in, if I have the money to spend, why would I spend it in country? The second, which we as a women's university experience, is who is willing to invest in women's education. I get students who cannot afford to pay for their basic tuition fee. And by tuition fee, what I mean is that we have a degree which costs $500 for 2.5 years of education in the university. So highly subsidized education, and they can't afford to pay that $500. So we are dealing with a population which is coming from villages, rural areas, and then if the family is not economically well off, their first investment is their son, not their daughter. And I think it's very important to appreciate the fact that we still, numbers might be improving, but the qualitative in-depth issues are still very much there for us. The third point is from the home country's perspective. Ranking of the institution and the standard of the program. Who is offering a TNE to you? What is the position of that particular program in the home country? Are we just open to pick up any program just because we want to have TNE? Or are we going to make a choice? Or are we given a choice as a developing country? Because of the aggressive marketing strategies, what is happening in our part of the world is that whoever is able to sell and package their program well, get an access. And do we really get to make a choice, or we don't get to make a choice? I think there is a strong need for mapping TNE in Pakistan. What is happening with the 100 plus universities in the country? What is happening, and especially the degree programs, short courses, certifications are one thing, but degree programs, I think, in terms of the quality assurance, we need to rethink where we're heading as a country. And I think that is where I would like to leave you with those questions, and hope that we'll have a discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Shikran, Dr. Rob. Okay, and Chris Hill, and then we'll get to Q&A and allow you to participate a bit.
Okay, thank you very much. Good afternoon. good morning still. I should make a slight admission to start with. I'm with the University of Nottingham Malaysia campus. I've been there for 5 and a bit years, and my university's been there for 13. But what I'm going to talk to today is less about my institutional role, but more about the broad TNE role in Malaysia, which ties in very nicely with the previous presenter's questions about mapping. The second slight confession is I'm presenting research done by a research group over the last couple of years, and one of our research members is also present at the conference and has been dotted around my sessions. I was on a pre-sessional workshop on Monday with a gentleman from the Parthenon group who had his own TV crew, and I thought that was effortlessly cool. I seem to travel with my own personal auditor, which is seemingly less cool, but perhaps indicative of the type of stuff that we're talking about. So if there are any mistakes, they are mine entirely, and Roz is clearly free to correct me. What I wanted to do, just very, very briefly, is provide you with just a little bit of background to the Malaysian case, for those of you that aren't possibly familiar. Malaysia is a relatively small country, perhaps, but a relatively big player in T&E. In many cases, we say that there are more T&E programs than anywhere else. We say that Malaysia invented T&E. We say that Malaysia developed T&E. Whether these are, strictly speaking, true, certainly the proliferation of T&E and the manner in which the developmental phases have come into being makes Malaysia a very interesting case study for the future of T&E, but also for countries like Pakistan that are looking to further develop and solidify T&E practices. Malaysia is a very, very popular destination for international students, 11th worldwide. About 72% of students in 2010 were in the private sector. Now, this private sector is in some cases international branch campuses, such as my own, or Monash, or Reading, Southampton, Newcastle, the ones that are coming. Private universities, private institutions, collaborations. We have gentlemen from Taylor's here as well. There are many different models. The Malaysian system, we go from college to university relatively quickly in some cases. There are many, many different variants of what an educational provider is. Suffice to say that there are lots of them. There are five apex research universities which are public, and then there are private, etc. There are, as I said before, essentially any type of T&E program that you can think of or fathom, we have it in some form. Franchise, credit transfer, external program, joint awards, dual awards, which Caroline referred to, and that's an area for continued and consistent investigation. Distance and branch faculty. Now, Malaysia, like a lot of other countries in our region, aims to be a tertiary educational hub. And we've heard during the day yesterday that hub here, hub there, everywhere a hub, hub. Every country wants to be a hub. We can't clearly have, unless we just say that half of the globe is now a hub, and we'll leave it at that. Malaysia certainly has had tremendous success. It has success in attracting both providers and clearly in attracting students. And the government is investing heavily in this type of attraction. You'll see here on the right-hand side, there are currently, 2011, so slightly dated now, 90,000 international students in Malaysia. The idea is to increase this to 200,000 by 2020. These are Ministry of Higher Education figures. That will indicate an increase of 600 billion ringgits to the economy, which is roughly 120 billion British pounds. You can understand why T&E is prevalent. It makes money for the country. It's a level of investment. When T&E started in Malaysia, it was a necessity. When they achieved independence in 57, the internal capacity to deliver degrees wasn't there to match demand. T&E became the solution to that immediate problem. It started with distance programs, so very, very low level of investment from the home provider. But a high level of return for Malaysia because of the numbers churned through. It evolved through to twinning, to franchise, to branch campuses, to now the newest model, part of the newest model, the EduCity, which obviously is very prevalent here in Dubai, where the government and private investment is creating a home for T&E. The ministry has now placed a moratorium on branch campuses coming in, and they have said, we will now control the strategic direction of education. And Malaysia is now actually looking to export T&E. So Malaysia is looking to set up branch campuses of its own abroad. So we've gone from nothing to Malaysia being not just a host, but also a provider of T&E. That having been said, it's been a relatively bumpy ride. And the regulatory framework has in some cases been effectively non-existent, and in some cases, absolutely tapping on your shoulder every single day. I mentioned about my own private auditor. The Nottingham Malaysia campus is audited by our good friends in QAA and by our good friends in MQA in Malaysia. And a couple of years ago, that happened back to back. That was a fun November. There are different processes of regulation of T&E. My university, for example, with the time that we've been in Malaysia, now has self-accrediting status. So what initially happened was a program that had been delivered on the UK campus would be accredited by the MQA because it had the credibility and the backing of the UK. But we still had to go for every single program, and we had to go through the same process. Now we are allowed to self-accredit, but of course we are still audited. So you don't just get to skate free, which is an entirely good thing. Now, I appreciate bureaucracy and regulatory frameworks are the bane of most of our existence, unless it is your job, in which case we, the people, are the bane of your existence because of some of our policies. But given that T&E doesn't have a global regulatory framework, and given that so many of the practices are dependent on what you can push through or what the government or the ministry wants or will allow, or there are variants in reality, there are variants in perception, and there are absolutely variants in quality. T&E can be a tremendous vehicle for positive social, economic, educational change. And the other side, the ugly truth we don't talk about, is it can be hugely damaging to the brand of the home country, the brand of the host country, and frankly, the educational sector more broadly. So it's something that I think merits some conversation. Very, very briefly, our study was looking at T&E policies and practices between the UK and Malaysia. Very, very strong historical relationship, previous colony, a lot of high-level Malaysian academics, business people, lawyers, etc., are educated in the UK or Australia, but we picked the UK. We used a series of different types of providers so that we could try and get a cross-section of the research, of the responses available. And we interviewed management staff and students. And the idea was initially to simply map T&E practices. What T&E exists in Malaysia and what form does it take? And that was our initial standpoint. What actually came out of the research was more about the perception of T&E. And this is the point I was making about the negative side of T&E. The proliferation of foreign providers in Malaysia has, to an extent, altered the perception of local educational provision. It becomes seen as the foreign, whatever the foreign may be, is better. Because we have to bring in the foreign because our local cannot simply meet capacity and therefore we cannot meet demand. That extends to the point where, and we see this on our China campus, we have students who do not want to go to a private university in Malaysia and be taught by non-white academics. Because the white academic represents the knowledge of Britain, which, if you've ever been to Britain, is absurd. But that's clearly perception and reality are very, very divorced from each other. And equally, given that a private university in Malaysia is 11 times the cost of a public, why would you pay to go private when you can get the same provision from your own people public? I mean, it's a business decision mentioned by Mariam, again, about what parents are prepared to pay for. So historically, international links existed to enable the issuance of degrees. As I said, there simply wasn't the capacity. T&E was an absolute necessity. The perception that locals viewed as inferior, we're moving our research now into employer perception as well, employer perception of T&E, and that's, I think, an interesting, which obviously the British Council have already begun, and we're going to look specifically in Malaysia. The government, therefore, and this is where I do not remotely envy Carolyn her job in the way QAA and MQA relates, because, as I said, the regulatory framework is changing. It's gone from being, as I said, very hands-off to very hands-on to a new phase which is, I think, still to be defined. Certainly, the manner in which the door is controlled has changed. It's not now an open-door policy where anybody can come in. Malaysia has taken control of T&E provision to map onto strategic direction. But that has only been a byproduct of the time since the 50s. One of the dangers, and Mary's point is, I think, fantastic, that the difficulty that host countries have is they don't always get to choose. T&E development is a power imbalance. Where can I go to deliver a program? I have the power, I have the credibility, I'm the Western shining beacon of educational merit, whatever that might be or not be. That's an imbalance of power. That can lead to abuse if the regulatory system is not in place and if partnership due diligence isn't done, absolutely. So I think just to conclude, and this is not just from our research project, but more broadly our research understanding of T&E, specifically within the Malaysian case, is that we need to redefine T&E understanding within Malaysia. As I said, the developmental phases have taken place, and Malaysia is pushing boundaries, I think, of what of how T&E can be conceptualised. And I think that's it's a fascinating, for me personally, it's a fascinating place to work and learn. We do, I think, see, we have seen an organic development, and partly this, as I said, because of levels of investment, partly it's because of government control, partly it's just because of time. Moving to quality assurance, not quality control, that is something that is possible when you have established partners who are there for the long haul, who are audited absolutely by their own regulatory framework, and who have that connection where the brand reputation is so key they cannot afford to abuse the system. But again, that's a byproduct of time, and that doesn't always happen with initial T&E investment or development. Transfer of power towards autonomy, which is an interesting case. I've done some work recently in Kurdistan, and the Minister of Higher Education attempted to increase the autonomy of the universities, and the universities fought back, because with autonomy comes accountability. And again, we're talking about internal capacity and internal understanding of provision. And I think then the final point is just value versus perceived value. And it's a point that we try to make across the conference. And I did actually quote my PVC on Monday, and I'll quote her again. My PVC for internationalization, Professor Christine Enyu, says that we have to be very careful assuming that T&E is always the answer unless we fully define the question. So, thank you.
Perfect. Thank you, Chris. We're going to open it up for questions now. What I'd like you to do is, could you just identify yourself? And if your question is directed at a particular member of the panel, please also include that in your question. So let's open it up and have some discussion. First question. Gentleman here in the front.
Michael Thompson from Texas, an Australian quality agency. Can you just reflect a little bit about what are the major lessons that have been learnt from your experience either in providing T&E or in reviewing T&E in the case of QAA? What are the things that can are most likely to go wrong, and how can institutions counteract those, and what are the good things they should be doing to make sure that T&E works?
Carolyn, you want to start, perhaps, with that?
Okay, fine. I would say that I think a lesson learned, and I think it's reflected a little bit in some of the things that others have been saying, is that it's a bit corny to say it, but one size doesn't fit all, either in terms of the shape of transnational education provision, or the way that it's quality assured, and that we are increasingly trying to contextualise our quality assurance reviews of T&E dependent on the nature of the regulatory framework, or whether one actually exists or not, the nature of the provision, and to some extent the provider. Like TEXA, we're moving to a risk-based quality assurance method within the UK, but we've always been risk-based outside the UK, particularly in terms of the sample of provision that we would look at. And I think we've become much more sophisticated about, I think it reflects a little bit about what our Greek colleague is saying in terms of surveying and trying to understand what's going on. That's important rather than just launching into something. One other thing that I would say, though, is, and I think it's, again, coming back to the one size doesn't fit all, is that T&E isn't homogeneous. It's not a homogeneous provision, and T&E students aren't a homogeneous population. And I think it's very important for us to realise that in carrying out T&E review. We've also learned, and I don't know how many times we have to say it, due diligence, due diligence, due diligence, and that avoiding due diligence or not carrying out effective due diligence can lead to disasters, and we've had one with that. The other thing is not being afraid perhaps to monitor things more closely at the start than you would do if something was at home. Not being afraid to do that until that you're sure that things are going well. Because we've seen people, and I think it's a kind of a reverse colonial thing, not wanting to look like they're imposing things, but in fact it's very necessary to be supportive and to monitor at the start of things. So that's a few lessons learned.
Miriam, would you like to comment on that?
I think something that I just mentioned, and because we are actually in the learning phase, is choosing the best suitable program, I think, is something which is of great significance in terms of the local need and also understanding the context. Because getting just importing without indigenization is something which is not, which has not worked out for us, and I think that would be the case with most of the most of such programs. Maximum incorporation of local knowledge into these programs is of great significance. But then going back to quality assurance and assessment, where do you place these programs? Are they then genuinely TNE, or is it something that you've adopted and adapted and are being presented as your own and not part of the other university, the home university?
Any other comments? Chris, you wanted to mention?
Yes, please. One of the things I'd say is that one of the difficulties of TNE partnership development is that a lot of it is done very ad hoc. It's personal relationships, it's personal introductions, and there's that system is a relatively fraught process at times, or can be at least. And I think what's key is that obviously, as we said, due diligence is obviously absolutely central, but that when those agreements are entered into, it's important that both parties have an understanding and manage expectations of what they're trying to achieve, and that certainly have some understanding of the context in which they're going to operate. So not just from an institutional perspective, but from a national framework, because national regulatory frameworks or absence thereof, risk factors included in that, I think, are very important to consider. And clearly, if you work in the part of the world where I work, in Asia, which is, I think, very similar to here, you'll need to spend the time face-to-face. You have to build up those relationships. You cannot establish TNE programs by email, as much as we would prefer from a green perspective. And so there's a huge setup cost, I think.
Gentleman back here, please.
I'm David Downsell from the other university. And I'm the director of international HR development. So do a lot of work internationally. Chris, you made a lot of reference to perceptions, and I think currently the perception of whenever we're working towards new programs with the quality assurance, I'm firmly a believer that the systems and structures should support rather than provide barriers to. But I think that in fact the reality is it does provide barriers, and that might just be a mindset that occurs. Mm-hmm. But I'm just wondering in terms of how you can do things to change those perceptions. And again, we've talked a lot through the conference about encouraging innovative creativity, and through many of these programs we're able to do this transnationally, but there is still this issue of the systems and procedures. From my perception within the university, it invariably is a nightmare to go through this, and I still refer always in meetings to a letter I've got with the corporate program with BP that says, we love your can-do attitude, to which my reply to them is, if you knew what I've got to go through to get this done, you'd probably view it differently. So it's a plea, really, for an understanding of how we can better eradicate that tension that obviously exists at the moment.
Can I just comment on
it?
I can give you an example of Pakistan in terms of doctoral studies. We have indigenous doctoral studies program, and we have students traveling on scholarships to foreign countries for doctoral studies. And then we have dual degrees. And I think that's they're all on a continuum. And the indigenous programs still are trying to gain credibility. Foreign programs are far too expensive, and dual degrees lie somewhere in the middle. And I think that continuum is where what you're referring to in terms of a specific program in context of Pakistan, that, yes, quality matters. It takes time for developing countries to reach, to bring their local programs to the level of advanced countries' programs. But the journey is kind of... You can trace it on the map.
Yeah. I'll just add a comment to that. It's hard to say this after 30 years in higher education, but the fact of the matter is universities really aren't very good at planning. I'm sorry to say that, but they really aren't. We're very good at reacting to whatever the latest thing is, and the vice chancellor or the president, depending on where you come from in the world, says, we've got this latest new opportunity. Well, that greatest new opportunity, if it's a TNE opportunity, requires two things. It requires incredible dialogue on your own campus, among your faculty, your administrators, all your key stakeholder groups. Remember what I said at the beginning of this session? Who are your stakeholders? Who are your priority stakeholders? And what are you telling them? Second part of this is TNE is not just about geographical boundaries. Is about crossing social, cultural, and linguistic boundaries. And we can talk about nice language like the global village and all those kinds of things. But the reality is you're entering into uncharted waters, and that takes time. And so then we're faced with these pressures that we've got to respond quickly. It's a competitive environment, even if we do it wrong. Remember the cliche, you never have a second chance to make a first impression. And that is true. Good partnerships take time. If you look at the Indian Ucari Research Partnership, if you talk to people who have been involved in this partnership, they will tell you it took an incredible amount of dialogue to make this work. And I think until we do that, you're going to continue to see quite a variation of perceptions on our campuses and trying to put these things into practice. Gentlemen here, please.
May not need the mic, but I'll try my best. Alan France. I work for the University of Westminster, where I'm based in Tashkent in Uzbekistan. I was just reflecting that I closed the first MBA franchise in 1990 in Kuala Lumpur, and now I operate at a university in Tashkent, Uzbekistan, where many people don't know exists, on behalf of the University of Westminster in partnership, and we had one of the best QAA results. And I was just reflecting on the models of TNE and also a comment about quality assurance and accountability, and about the stakeholders' perceptions at the beginning of this. And I was just thinking of the three Fs, I would call it. Foreign is best, and often the comment is, and how many foreigners have you got, and what's the ratio you need? And I think you're right about bringing white-skinned males, generally speaking, to teach is the only result of quality. Also, franchising, and I hope it sucks. I'm using that quite deliberately, because I hope that's buried in the future. And the other one is flying faculty, which I often think is flying ignorance. And I was just wondering as about the panel's comments about those three Fs, because I think in my experience of 20 years, I've often been seen as the white male coming in to give the quality education. I've often seen, can we have exactly what you've got? And the last one is, can we get your staff? And all three, my answer's been no. And this is why I think the last model I've used in the last 10 years has worked far better than the MBA program was started in 1990 and why that failed. And I don't think it's any different now. And I was quite interested about your comment about quality assurance means accountability. And I think local providers, that's what is important, is that they own the brand and it's not owned by the home institution. And it's their jobs online and it's their reputation, which can suck if they don't get it right. So it's just like a comment from the panel members. I found it very interesting, one of the more interesting events today is going global. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Do you want to comment?
If Donald's mind, I can kick this off. Well, thank you very much for the comments. I mean, the three Fs are... Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, I completely agree with you. To be frank, it's quite sometimes an uncomfortably intellectual space to occupy. I've done training and capacity building in Iraq, Tanzania, Ghana, Thailand, China, etc. The key driver from a lot of these places tends to be a shopping list approach. Just give us exactly what you've got. You come in, you deliver it, and then you go away, and our KPIs are ticked, and we are now what you are. My post-colonial white guilt, coupled with my educational philosophy, says, well, no, clearly that doesn't work. We need to build sustainable internal capacity so that you can buy-in, so precisely you can have what you say. People genuinely identify with the brand within which they work, and therefore they work towards developing that rather than working for an absentee landlord, perhaps. But I think it's, in some cases, it's a very real cultural issue that we have to tackle. And it's partly a byproduct of the way in which we in the, and I use this word entirely wrongly, enlightened West have commercialized and offered education abroad. I think it's a byproduct of the way in which education is viewed in certain countries, which is we must have that, and the best way to have that is to fly people in and have that done. And I think it's a perception of educational value that has to change. But I think it's a natural evolution of the development of these particular countries. But therefore, and I would agree, I think we have a responsibility to change that model because that model will not be changed from the receiving country.
I agree. I think UK, put this way, has sold its quote position and not actually developed the countries in which it's in. Malaysia's just coming out of that.
Yeah, but I mean, that's taken 60 years.
Yeah.
We're getting close to lunchtime. We're going to take one more question and then we're going to wrap up. The gentleman in the back. You. Yes, you, sir.
Thank you, Chair. My question is to Christopher again. First of all, thank you very much for your excellent presentation. Thank you for raising some very sensitive issues. And it's comforting to see that this is coming from a TNE provider and not from the other end. My question to you is, I think Malaysia is known to have some very good universities in the public sector and some very good providers, some very good research being done, some very strong universities. After so many years, what I would like to know is, what do you think has been the effect of the presence of TNE on those public universities? Have they been strengthened? Have they been weakened? Is there collaboration between TNE and those universities? I think it's interesting to know, this relationship between the TNEs and the local public institutions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the question, and I'll attempt to quickly answer that. There absolutely has been an impact. It's been both positive and negative, depending on the time frame that we operate. Currently, I would say it's very positive. Private universities can now bid for government funding, but they must do so in collaboration with public institutions. So the government structure has kick-started or forced collaboration on a research level, and that has been very, very encouraging. We're now seeing joint dual degree schemes between public and private institutions, so that's been very useful. However, historically, I think we fall into that same sort of perception question, which is, what are the foreign providers here to do? Are they in competition or are they in collaboration? And the reality is that they should be collaboration because it's a very niche market that the public universities don't have to worry about just because of the cost of the private universities and the nature of government funding for education. And so the difficulty was initially public universities tried to compete against the private when it's not a game they need to play. They have their own value, they're research intensive, they are who they are. And I think, but that was a byproduct of unknown. TNE providers come in and come and go, but big branch campus, that changes the nature of the game. So I think initially it could be seen as being competitive, but that's simply through lack of understanding or lack of cooperation. It has certainly evolved into a much more collaborative and sustainable capacity building. When you look at things like Sunway and Monash, you're starting to see a procedure where foreign and local become a new identity of education, which I think is a very positive development for the country.
Yeah, that's good. Obviously, lots of issues to talk about. Thank you very much, Shukran Jazilin. Would you join me in thanking our panel?
This is a podcast from the British Council's Going Global 2013.